From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Let's be honest, a lot of us are thinking about fat. You can tell by the number of commercials for gyms and fitness programs. And this is what you hear about fat, that it's ugly and dangerous, and having it is a sign of weakness and gluttony. The biochemist Sylvia Tara says our concerns about obesity make sense, of course, but treating fat like a vicious enemy doesn't. Because, as she says in her new book, we're spending billions in this war against fat, and it always returns. Clearly, we don't understand this enemy we're fighting. Today in the program, Tara is joining us to explain what fat is exactly, how it works, and why the body is so good at holding on to it. As it turns out, we need fat. Fat is good. Join us after the news.
Love what you hear? Radio West podcast is made possible in part by thousands of KUER sustainers, along with Albion Financial Group, wealth advisors since 1982. Albion values local organizations helping to enrich the community through the power of ideas. Find out more online at albionfinancial.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. At the beginning of Sylvia Tara's book, she writes, "Poor fat, so reviled, so shameful, so unloved." And that's how we think of it. In fact, it might be surprising to some of you that there's another way of looking at fat. But as Tara points out, we're fighting this war on fat, spending something like $60 billion a year on it. And still, fat is winning. Tara says there's an important reason fat wins. It's because we need it to live. Fat is good. It protects us from disease. It's crucial to our brains, our hearts. Without it, reproduction would be impossible. So Tara is trying to get people to think differently about fat, to learn to respect it and appreciate it. Tara is a biochemist, trained as a scientist, but it was a personal struggle to manage her weight that got her started on this subject. Today in the program she's joining is to explain how fat works and what fat is. Her book is The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You. Sylvia Tara is a biochemist. She joins us from the studios of public radio station KUCI on the campus of the University of California, Irvine. And Sylvia Tara, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I wanted to begin with an interesting element of the book, and that is that it's personal. I want to begin with this. You wanted to apply your role as a scientist to this problem you were having with your own weight. Would you start there? I guess that's the way that you really began thinking about all of this.
That's right. I'm a biochemist by training, and I was always pretty heavily, you know, into the science. But I just noticed throughout my life, I gained weight very, very easily, even as a child. I couldn't eat as much as other people around me. They seemed to eat freely, not exercise much, and yet somehow stay thinner. And I went on a number of diets. They'd work for a while, temporarily. I could even gain weight on a diet, depending on the diet. And personal trainers, people found this very puzzling. And it finally got to the point that I got very frustrated with this, and I decided I am going to understand everything there is to know about fat. I am a scientist. I can dig in. I've got the tools to really research this. And I spent 5 years reading through the scientific literature, almost every article I could find, well over 1,000. And I spoke to dozens of leading researchers around the world about this cutting-edge research on fat. And what I was finding out was so astounding, so surprising, I thought I really have to capture this in a book. And The Secret Life of Fat is that book.
There's this moment you write about where you were a PhD student and you had gone out to dinner with friends. And this friend of yours, a woman named Lindsay, who was quite short and quite slender, yet never went to the gym, ate kind of whatever she wanted. And at this one particular moment you write about, she had ordered this beer and this like big burrito, and she just wolfed it down. And you describe this moment in the book as profound, like this moment that confirmed, as you put it in the book, that you were not normal. What do you mean by that? And tell this story, if you would.
So normal seems to be what we see everywhere. We see these big breakfasts advertised. We see, you know, full lunches and dinners advertised. And you know, there's an eating world of people who eat, and they can eat plenty, and they don't really have a penalty. They don't seem to gain weight. They don't seem to have to work very hard at it. And really, you know, since I was 12, I think I had to start working at it. As puberty approached, it wasn't easy. I gained weight very easily. I was never really normal, if you would. So my friends, when I was young, they would eat candy and ice cream in the summertime. If I ate that, I would gain weight. And I just observed this throughout my teens, you know, throughout college. And so this dinner with Lindsay was just this pinnacle of here we go again. You know, here's this woman. She is petite. She couldn't be more than 5 feet. You know, she weighed probably under 100 pounds. And she just ate this. It didn't even think twice about it. It was like a normal day. Yeah, I'm eating this gigantic burrito and this big beer, and I'm wolfing it down, and so what? In the meantime, you know, here I am restricting, eating a salad, trying to be very careful. I'd worked out. And she was probably still thinner than me. And I think it just, one of those moments where I've had it, you know, this is not normal. I know it's not. And someday I'm going to find out the reason for this. And of course, that came later, because I had that experience again later in life. And it was finally the trigger that got me going to research this.
Before we move on to the sort of particulars of what fat is and how it works, explain the conclusion you've come to about your weight, just broadly, which may give us some, I think, broader insights about this, that some people hold fat, some people don't. Yes?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's all kinds of reasons we gain weight. And it's not just gluttony, overeating, and lack of exercise. That's the very common prescription. It might be the things that we have to work with, but we can't ignore that there's some people who pack on more fat than others, and multiple reasons for this, not just food. One is the bacteria in our gut will have a really big effect on how much calories we extract out of food versus not. Even viruses are correlated to fatness. You know, genetics has a role here. There's certain genes that give you a propensity for fatness. There's certain races that have a genotype that helps them gain more weight than others. You know, our gender, having two X chromosomes doesn't help when you're coming to dieting. And age and hormones. As we get older, our fat-burning hormones start to decline. We start to put on more weight, so we can't eat as much. You might have eaten a plate of spaghetti when you were young. Now if you eat it, you will gain weight. And so I just wanted to learn all the different ways that we put on weight. I really had to answer the questions of why some people can eat more than others. And all of that then is really, you know, researched, and it's in the book as things to think about. And none of this is an excuse to be fat, you know, right, to go out and gain weight and so what. It's just understand your body, because you might have to tweak the diet you're on, up it a little bit, you know, get more intense with it before you can really lose weight that other people can lose.
This was interesting. You say that fat wasn't always hated. In fact, here's how you say it in the book. Fat was once humankind's admired companion. Talk about the way we used to think about fat, if you would.
Yeah, so I open up with this, and that's true. You know, in America even, fat was actually once loved and admired. There was a time after the Civil War where food was hard to come by. There was poverty and destruction, and it was hard times. Not many people had fat. In that time, fat was actually seen as status, as wealth. In fact, there was a Fat Man's Club that opened in 1866. Right. And men had to be fat enough to join. It was said that a fat wallet makes for a fat man. There were celebrities like Lillian Russell, who was over 200 pounds, the opera singer. Women padded themselves to look like her. There were even books on how to get fat, columns running in newspapers on how to help people gain weight. And women would even write in on how to not be so skinny. So very different time for fat. That started changing as America came out of the Civil War, started to repair, industrialization took place. Food became more plentiful, and people started gaining weight. And this kind of irked some of the leaders when they saw all people gaining weight, and they warned about being fat wasn't pious. Religious leaders warned on that. Military leaders wanted strong bodies for the army. Business leaders wanted agile, fit bodies for factories. And it became this chorus among people about, you know, be wary of fat. And it actually became a judgment at that point. It wasn't just about fat. That's when terms like slob, you know, fatty, all these derogatory terms started coming into use, too, about fat people. So naturally, people got quite nervous about their fat. They became very self-conscious about it. And it was a wide opening for businesses, because when you have a whole population that's scared of something, you can sell things. And all kinds of entrepreneurs and hucksters, peddlers started selling very weird things for fat. there's fat off soap. It was supposed to dissolve fat under your skin. Rubber suits to sweat away your fat. Tapeworm diet. People would actually eat tapeworms, hoping it would siphon off some energy. And finally, over time, these small peddlers gave way to billion-dollar corporations, and we now spend $60 billion a year trying to fight our fat, which is oddly more than we spend on Homeland Security on their net budget. And so we're fighting this enemy, if you will, but clearly we don't understand it enough because our hatred of it is way up. We spend more on it. We try everything to lose it, yet it remains. And I think we have to understand it better to use that $60 billion effectively.
Let's say something about metabolism for a moment, because in the book you write about how the calorie became introduced and how it really came to be kind of the landmark in this obsession we had, still have, overweight. The calorie was defined in the 1800s. That surprised me, I guess, a little bit. There's a man named Wilbur Atwater who did all of these studies, and at some point the calorie becomes this kind of standard measurement of food value. I guess the question is, should it be? I mean, and are we misunderstanding or misapplying the idea of a calorie?
I think we metabolize food differently, and people are very individual. And this is what's coming to light more and more in the research and even some journals now, is that, you know, so fat might not be as bad as we think because we are a bag of biochemistry, if you will. So, you know, when we put something in, it doesn't necessarily work just to burn energy and just to provide that. It actually might have different effects. And so sugar, for example, might have a teaspoon of sugar and a teaspoon of fat. One might have more calories than the other. But a teaspoon of sugar actually has these consequences when you take that in. I mean, it releases more insulin. It clears your blood more. It puts things more into fat tissue. It helps you store fat. So it will have a different effect than, say, a teaspoon of fat. How you eat things together, if you eat fat and that sugar together, are you going to put even more fat away? If you ate just the fat alone, you might not put that away. It might go to other uses than just burning energy and storing away. And so I think it's become more complicated than that. You know, there had to be some measure of food. I mean, it's needed for livestock and farming. You have to be able to somehow measure the energy of food. And it wasn't a bad way to start, but I think we're learning so much more the intricacies of the human body and how we metabolize things that we put into our body.
The way you've written the book and sort of worked through a lot of these kind of complex, arcane ideas is through narratives. I mean, telling stories has seemed to be the way to kind of make this, I think, more compelling, not just understandable. So let's sort of talk about this one question you ask, and that is, what would life be like if you didn't have any fat? And this gives us an opportunity to talk about one of the stories in the book, a woman by the name of Christina. Tell us about Christina and how what she sort of teaches us about what would happen if you didn't have any fat.
Yeah, so Christina, it's an interesting story. She has a condition called lipodystrophy, and that's where your fat deposits actually dissolve. They disappear. And that's when you start to really understand how important fat tissue is. So going back on Christina a little bit, when she was 12, she was in New Jersey growing up, she was pretty normal. And then somewhere in there, she started to lose fat in her face, and later the rest of her body as well. And then she developed these very weird blisters on her skin, actually fluid-filled blisters, and they were very painful. Her parents took her to a dermatologist, thinking it was a skin disorder. But when he did her metabolic panel, her cholesterol and triglycerides and glucose, they were very, very high. Her triglyceride level was 100 times more than what it normally is.
Wow.
And you quickly learn that this is not a dermatology issue, it's an endocrinology issue, until he sent her to an endocrinologist and he started treating her for diabetes, thinking she had this. But all the while she took these diabetes meds, her weight continued to drop and her appetite was very large. So it was a very unusual pairing. She could not stop eating, this girl, and she said she would eat anything. It didn't have to taste good. She would eat a can of mushrooms, anything she could get her hands on. It was almost pathological. At the same time, her weight was dropping drastically. She was losing all her fat. So her endocrinologist, realized it wasn't quite diabetes, and he sent her off to NIH, to one of their specialty units. And that's where she was diagnosed with lipodystrophy, that condition where you lose your fat. And so in the beginning, there was not much they could do for her. They put her on plasmapheresis. It's like dialysis. They take your blood out, and they clear it out of fats and triglycerides. And they were preparing for an early death for this child. And the doctor said that her blood was just about cream-colored. It was so full of fat that you couldn't even see through it. And so she had to do this three times a week. But then finally, a discovery at Rockefeller University turned out to be a huge help to Christina. And what they found out at Rockefeller University is that fat is not just fat. It's not just sitting there reserving calories, actually. It actually produces hormones that our body depends on.
Yeah.
And one hormone it produces is leptin. And leptin's tied to appetite, and it's tied to metabolism. So if someone has a defect with fat, they don't have enough fat, or they just have a genetic defect that their fat doesn't make this leptin, their appetite goes through the roof. And this is why Christina could not stop eating. She didn't have enough fat. And so her brain wasn't getting the signal that, you know, that you can stop eating. She would eat everything. And because she ate so much, she had very high triglyceride, sugar, and cholesterol levels in her blood. So she went on a trial where she was able to get injections of leptin. And amazingly, a few days later, her appetite dropped tremendously. And when that happened, her blood panel improved, her triglyceride level improved. She didn't have to take diabetes medication anymore. And she normalized somewhat. The blisters under her skin, those were fat-filled deposits. And it's because fat had nowhere to go. There was no fat tissue. And so they diminished as well. And Christina's really, she's alive today thanks to this discovery of leptin and learning that fat is not just fat. It's a very complex endocrine organ.
Well, I think that's the takeaway, at least for me on her story, is that the doctors were all of a sudden realizing that fat in Christine was, as you put it, circulating endlessly in her bloodstream. Like it wasn't really going anywhere, which tells us what fat ultimately, I guess, is supposed to do or what it's supposed to be. It's an organ, right? It's a explain how it's part of our endocrine system and what it does then.
Yeah, sure. And this is always surprising for people, and it was certainly surprising for me. So fat in its simplest form is just a molecule of carbon atoms. And when we need energy, that molecule can go through a degradative process where it lets go of energy and releases energy to the body. And, you know, that fat is stored in fat cells, and fat cells are stored in fat tissue, and fat tissue is all over your body. Collectively, fat tissue functions as an organ. It's not too unlike your skin. If you just have a piece of skin, it's a piece of skin tissue. But skin all over our body is considered an organ, meaning it's self-contained and provides a specific vital function. And what fat does is it releases a number of hormones, not just leptin. That's the one I've talked about so far, but adiponectin is another important one. It also releases estrogen, so it can make and release estrogen into the body. And in fact, women going through menopause, they start to depend on their fat for estrogen. And so as a producer of these hormones, a lot of different body parts depend on leptin and depend on these hormones that fat is creating. Just like we depend on our pituitary gland or our thyroid gland, we actually depend on our fat. And because it's so important, our body protects fat. It really doesn't want you to lose it. So we might not value fat, but our body really does. And so when you try to lose weight, when you lose fat, you lose leptin, right? Because fat produces leptin.
Yeah.
And because leptin is tied to appetite, usually when we have sufficient leptin, we're pretty satiated, and our metabolism is quite high. But when we lose fat, we lose leptin, and our appetite goes through the roof, quite honestly. You know, our metabolism gets slower. Mm-hmm. It's our body's way of fighting to get fat back on. It really doesn't want you to lose it. And you really have to be aware of this to understand fat's survival strategies, if you will. Because once you've gained weight and lost it, you actually need fewer calories than before compared to someone who hasn't lost weight.
Yeah.
So say there's someone who's 150 pounds, and then there's someone who's 170 pounds but lost 20 pounds to get to 150 pounds. The person who has lost weight needs 22% fewer calories than the person who's at 150 pounds naturally.
Wow.
And this effect lasts for quite a while. It's been studied for up to 6 years. Researchers aren't sure if it ever really goes away. And so there's a real change to, for yo-yo dieting, there's actually a change to your body. You need fewer calories going forward. And the interesting thing is that it doesn't really matter how you lose your fat. When people get liposuction, they have the same effect. Their metabolism goes down, and they actually have to exercise more to not get fat regain. So fat's very tricky, and you really have to understand it if you want to sustainably lose weight.
You say that in ancient Greece, physicians, early thinkers, thought fat was congealed blood. Hippocrates thought it was, he said fat was moistness. And I guess the idea being is everyone sort of figured that fat just came from body fluids. But you say once the microscope was developed, it kind of deepened our understanding of fat. When did scientists start to realized that fat was something more than just this blob.
Yeah, so the microscope, I think, looking first very closely at fat, you know, Antony van Leeuwenhoek was able to see that it was composed of vesicles, which is what it was, a cell actually. At the time, he called it a vesicle. And that's, you know, when you started looking at it, starting to understand, that was just a start. I think a couple hundred years later, people started realizing that fat was, you know, actually full of fat molecules, and that, you know, if they were composed of cells full of fat molecules would then compose, you know, fat, which made fat. And I started understanding a little bit about how fat works. And that was probably in the early 1900s where we got a very good handle on some of these things, that we eat excess nutrients. They actually can get shuttled to the liver. The liver then converts those extra nutrients into fat, which gets deposited into our fat cells. And it was learned later that fat could actually make its own fat, too. And this wasn't known, you know, before this time, is that, you know, fat's not just sitting there. It can absorb glucose and make its own fat as well.
We have more than one type of fat. In fact, we have different, I guess, colors is the way to put it, although not terribly colorful. White and brown, and there's even beige. Start with white fat.
Sure. Yeah, so white is the type of fat that we want to lose all the time. It's the one that hoards energy. It stores it for us. And white fat is stored right under the skin, and that's your subcutaneous fat. So you're in your thighs, your buttock area, your hips, your arms. That's subcutaneous fat. There's also white visceral fat, and this is a fat that's stored underneath your stomach wall. And this is a type that tends to get inflamed and is associated with diabetes and with heart disease. But there's also brown fat, and this is fat that actually burns energy for heat. So, you know, rather than storing energy in a time of need, it's actually burning it up and producing heat in our bodies, and it's around our heart area and around our spine and clavicles. And then there's a newly discovered type of fat called beige fat. And this is fat that can turn brown and does so upon certain triggers. And one of them is exercise. If you actually exercise more, there's a protein called irisin that will turn your beige fat into brown fat. And there's all kinds of experimentation now about, can we inject brown fat into, you know, people? Right. And will that help burn calories? Yeah. You know, is there a way to increase your brown fat levels? And another way to increase is actually exposure to cold. They'll see that some of these people have higher stores of brown fat, and certainly in animals they're seeing that. So a very new area of research.
So if brown fat burns energy, it seems like, oh, that's great. That's where we want to be, but it's not quite that simple. Talk about Joycelyn Rees. Because she sort of gives us this perspective that you can, in fact, have too much, I think, brown fat.
That's right. So Joycelyn was a child in London, and it was a very puzzling case for doctors. She was born very light, you know, really, I think it was just a few pounds or so, and they had to really keep her, you know, alive, keep her in incubators, and they finally sent her home, thought she was on her way. But year after year, she couldn't gain weight. You know, at 3 years old, she was only 6 pounds.
Yeah.
And she was brought back to the hospitals, and the doctor was really stumped. And, you know, it was Khalid Hussein. And even after reaching out, you know, internationally to the medical community, has anyone ever seen something like this? He really couldn't get an answer on what was wrong with her. She was on intravenous glucose. Her insulin sensitivity was very good, but she was taking in thousands of calories a day, even as a very young child, a toddler. And she was just burning them off, all of them. And, you know, finally a hint came. They took a biopsy of her fat, and she had a lot of brown fat. And apparently she was just, because brown fat burns energy instead of storing it, she was burning off all of this glucose, everything that they kept feeding her, and she was just unable to gain weight. And even at 3 years old, she was only 6 pounds. And, you know, sadly, she passed away. There wasn't anything they could do for her.
Right.
So brown fat might sound like this great thing, but anything in too big of an amount can actually be a problem. This was a very unique case. I don't know that there's been one like it reported anywhere else in the world. But you can have just too much of this, what is supposed to be a good thing, even.
Sylvia Tara is with us. Her book is The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Body fat is a source of shame for many people, something to be hidden and fought and burned away. But Fat, says the biochemist Sylvia Tara, isn't just unsightly blubber. It's an essential and deeply misunderstood organ that's vital to our existence. In her book, Tara explores the science behind our most unappreciated organ. It's called The Secret Life of Fat. She's joining us today to talk about it. I wanted to ask you about this idea, if we have these multiple types of fat, are scientists anywhere near trying to figure out, and the sort of the message from Jocelyn Reese that we learned was that you have to have the right balance of it. Can you artificially take brown fat and white fat? And I mean, does it work like that? Or are you going to have to sort of get the body to figure this all out?
There's research going on now where they're doing this in mice. They're taking brown fat, you know, out of one mice, putting into another mice, increasing the proportion of brown fat. And yes, it works. It works to burn calories, and it works, you know, to keep them a little thinner. We're way off from that being applied to humans, so I wouldn't count on that anytime soon. Yeah. You can naturally increase your proportions of brown fat. Exercise will, as we talked about, that'll increase it. Exposure to cold, a cold swim can actually increase the amount of brown fat we have. That's not necessarily going to be the cure for obesity. I mean, that's one angle. Yeah. But, you know, there's a lot of things that you really have to think about to take care of obesity. I mean, you know, one is to know is that you can actually be fit but fat. We talked about visceral fat, and visceral fat is the most dangerous. It's if it becomes inflamed, which it does when fat cells become crowded in your stomach area, it actually affects insulin sensitivity. Mm-hmm. And when we're not as sensitive to insulin, we don't internalize sugars and fats out of the blood, and they roam around, and they start depositing in your heart, in your liver, places they shouldn't be. And that becomes quite dangerous. And not only that, but because you're not absorbing sugars and fats, you're actually hungrier and you want to eat more. And it creates this vicious cycle where you eat, your fat gets crowded, it becomes inflamed, and you can get diseases from it. And so the visceral fat is the most dangerous type. I do talk about this idea of fit but fat, and I give the example of sumo wrestlers.
Right.
So sumo wrestlers, as we know, they're obese. By any measure, they're obese. They're 300-400 pounds. They eat, you know, thousands of calories a day. But somehow they're metabolically healthy, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And so the other talent, if you will, that fat has is it releases another hormone called adiponectin.
Right.
And adiponectin actually keeps us healthy. It guides fats from the blood out of the blood and puts them into subcutaneous fat tissue, which is a healthy storage of fat. And so it's fat's own way of saying, you know, fat molecule, come home. Come home to fat where you belong. Exercise promotes the release of adiponectin. Sumos exercise, hard exercise, for 6 or 7 hours a day. And they don't eat much processed food, though they do eat thousands upon thousands of calories a day.
Yeah.
And this combination actually keeps them healthy. They don't have a lot of visceral fat. It's mostly subcutaneous fat. Even that belly fat, it's right under the skin. It's not under the stomach wall. Amazingly enough, when they come off their diets and they stop exercising, sumo wrestlers will actually get metabolically unhealthy pretty quickly.
Huh.
And so, you know, you can be fit but fat. It's best not to have too much fat.
Sure.
But if you have some, you know, you can keep it healthier by keeping your subcutaneous depots instead.
You're right about how fat can talk. Let's talk about another story in the book that gives us a sense of this. This is Layla Malik. Tell her story and how that sort of explains to us how fat talks, I guess.
Yeah, so we learned that fat can talk through the research of these two fat mice. Two scientists and two fat mice kind of brought this to us. And it was Doug Coleman working at Jackson Laboratory, and he was tasked with understanding the difference between these two genetically defective mice. One was called OB, one was called DB. Both of them had unstoppable eating behavior. They couldn't stop eating. And they both had diabetes, although DB had a more intense version of diabetes than the OB mouse.
Yeah.
And so Doug Coleman had this idea, well, there's something in the blood of DB that's causing this intense form of diabetes. And he had this idea to put the blood of DB into OB to see what would happen. Would it make OB's diabetes worse? So he actually used this technique called parabiosis, where you sew the two mice together, you hook them up together, and they can exchange each other's blood. I know it sounds kind of shocking, but it's a technique that can be used. And he expected to see that OB would get this worse form of diabetes, but that's not what happened. Instead, what happened is OB stopped eating. It lost its appetite completely. So this mouse that was gorging itself on food now suddenly had no interest in food, to the point that it actually died. And it was quite interesting, really. And he couldn't, you know, reconcile this. What he came up with was this hypothesis of there's something in DB mouse's blood that controls appetite. It doesn't control diabetes the way he thought. It more controls appetite. And DB is not responding to this factor. There's something about DB that doesn't let it react. But OB must be missing this factor. And when you put this factor into the OB mouse, it actually can stop eating. And so it became called this missing factor is what it was called. And Coleman hypothesized if you can find this missing factor, this could be a treatment for obesity. And, you know, it's very hard to do this kind of research. And Doug Coleman tried for years to find this missing factor, and he actually couldn't. Now, finally, Jeffrey Friedman, mm-hmm. in around 1986, he starts this lab. He becomes determined to find this missing factor. And so he actually spent 8 years just mating mice together, you're trying to understand what traits are inherited with obesity. And doing that would help him hone in on what part of the DNA the gene for the missing factor might be on. And so what Friedman ultimately determined was that fat makes this hormone called leptin.
Yeah.
And leptin actually, you know, reaches our brain, it controls appetite, and it can also reduce metabolism. So what was happening is the OB mouse wasn't making this. It had defective fat. Its fat was unable to make leptin. So its brain never got the signal that it had any fat. It thought it had no fat and no food. It kept it eating. The DB mouse, on the other hand, had a defect in its hypothalamus, which is where leptin binds to in the brain. And so even though it had plenty of leptin, it wasn't responding to it, which is why it didn't react when they were sewed together. Only the OB mouse had a reaction. And so it was one of the first, you know, experiments showing that fat is not just fat. It's actually talking. It's talking to our brain and telling us how much fat we have and do we need to eat more or not. So a lot going on with your fat that you never expected.
Talk about Layla Malik. Right. How does she fit into this story?
Yeah, so, you know, all the while this is going in and Jeffrey Friedman is looking at mice trying to understand what's going on with this missing factor. There's a girl in London. And she can't stop eating. From the time she is very young, you know, soon after birth, she's got this pathological drive to eat, and no one can understand it. And, you know, of course, she gets blamed for it. Her parents get blamed for not taking care of her. You know, it's this appetite. You know, it's not a normal appetite. These kids eat, you know, no matter what. So, like, she'll break into a locked freezer to eat raw frozen fish. You know, it's at that level of really needing to eat. And she's finally sent to a hospital where they think, you know, they can control her food there and that they can help her. And so they do restrict her calories, but she continues to gain weight just more slowly.
Right.
And she finally comes out and everyone's just kind of accepting that she could very well die from an early death from complications of obesity. And then finally, when the leptin comes out, when it's announced to the world that there's this hormone produced by fat, her doctors manage to get a sample of this, and they start to wonder, is she this human version of the OB mouse? Does she have this defective gene? And they did a test at one time, and they thought not, and it turned out that they didn't do the test quite right. So they did it a second time, and they found out that, yes, she actually is just like the OB mouse. She's missing this gene for where leptin's supposed to be. And so they start injecting her with leptin when they realize she's missing this, and days later, her appetite drops. You know, she's eating almost a quarter about what she used to eat. She starts, you know, acting more normal. She's not as obsessive about food anymore. She starts moving around a little bit more because leptin actually affects, you know, our activity, our metabolism. So her metabolism goes up and she's a little bit more motivated. And, you know, after about a year or two of this, she's actually quite normal. Mm-hmm. She's not eating all the time. Her weight drops very much. And so, you know, the discovery of leptin really helped people like Layla. And this isn't a common genetic defect. Not too many people have it. But for people like Christina, who didn't have enough fat and couldn't produce leptin, or people like Layla, who had a genetic defect, you know, they had fat, it just doesn't produce leptin, it was a very big help for people like this. And there are people who are alive today thanks to that discovery from Jeffrey Friedman and Doug Coleman.
You say fat is so important. Nature ensures we have it beginning in the womb. And it even comes, or at least plays a role before that. Talk about how fat plays a role in human reproduction, because it's crucial.
Yeah, women who don't have enough fat really can't conceive. And so this was work done by Rose Frisch at Harvard very early on, and she was a real pioneer in this. And she was actually not paid any attention to when she first brought this up. She was actually in the Population Center at Harvard, and she was doing studies on how to feed the world population, what's the need for food going to be worldwide. And she was doing these studies in Pakistan, analyzing the population. And she noticed that girls from rich neighborhoods in Pakistan would menstruate years earlier than girls from poorer neighborhoods.
Right.
And she couldn't quite tease this out. And after some years of research, she started wondering why, and she focused it finally, she determined that it was due to their fat levels. It wasn't because of bone. It wasn't because of age. It wasn't because of height. It actually really got down to how much fat these girls have. And so it turns out that fat actually produces estrogen and produces leptin, and you can't quite go through puberty or can't initiate it as a girl unless you have sufficient fat. And they find with athletes now and ballerinas, you know, if they are really exercising a lot, not eating a lot, very low fat levels, if they haven't started menstruating, it's delayed for years. If they have started menstruating, it actually stops or becomes infrequent. And so they can't quite conceive. And when I talk to doctors here in Southern California, another issue is, of course, eating disorders. And they say that the women that come in, there's a lot of them that come in, and they just don't have enough fat. And so they're not menstruating normally, and they can't quite conceive. And so fat is really vital, you know, vital for reproduction, vital for the human race, for propagating. And I just wish teenagers would know this, because they're always so into dieting, and they want to get rid of their fat and look very good in their jeans. But, just for puberty and for our development, and even bone development in girls, it's very important, our fat.
You mentioned how fat can enhance our brain size. What's the relationship between fat and that, and also fat and bone? Because you write a lot about that, too.
Yeah. So our brains have a very big component of fat in them. They actually, myelin, which insulates axons and helps the nerve signal transmission, is 85% made of fat. And so important to know that fat isn't just storing calories. It has other important functions in our body as well. And one of them is this insulation for our brains. Now, they find that with mice, if they have genetic defect, and their fat is not making leptin, they have smaller brain size as well. In fact, I heard one researcher say that he could tell if a fat had this OB defect or some defect in leptin just by looking at the brains of the mice. That's how profound it is. It's clearly visible. When you inject leptin back into these mice, they actually start growing brain tissue again. Wow. And so, our fat is directly linked to our brain size and brain functioning. Also, when they look at children who have a defect in the leptin gene, they have smaller regions of their brain, those having to do with hunger, satiation, memory, and learning. And when they give them leptin, those parts of the brain start to fortify again. And then anorexics as well, anorexia nervosa patients, they have diminishing volume in their brain as well. And so, never underestimate fat. We might want to, get rid of it. We might not like it. It's unsightly. But it has these really profound functions in our body. And then bone, the other organ that you mentioned, bone is directly linked with fat, and particularly in teenage girls. So, as we were talking about, there's stem cells, they can turn to bone, they can turn into fat. And one of the things that's a trigger is weight. So if we have a substantial weight, adequate weight, that is a trigger for those cells, those stem cells, to turn into bone cells. Fat also produces estrogen. So if we have low fat, we don't have the weight trigger, and our fat produces estrogen, we won't have enough estrogen. And so our bones don't really build up as well. And this is why, particularly for girls developing, it's important to have sufficient fat so they can have really good bone health. And it has effects, long term if you don't grow your bones adequately in your teenage years. And so some very good work coming out of Britain on the importance of fat for teenage girls.
But, this is the thing that makes it difficult. You can say, on paper, fat is good for you, young ladies. This is really good. But then there's these cultural expectations and body image, and that's really fighting against it. And that seems to be one of the biggest problems, that these cultural ideas about, it may have been the case, before the Civil War in the United States, that fat was seen as kind of good. To be plump was good, but that's not the case anymore. What do you manage to do with that obstacle?
Yeah, fat is not just fat. It's a judgment. It's a characterization. And if you have fat, you're at the very least uncool. At the very most, you're considered a slob. You're considered lazy. And so there's so much more that we impute onto fat than just the organ that it is. And obesity is not an answer. I'm not promoting obesity. I don't want that to come across. But I think having a healthy amount of fat is really what's important. And so if people can get off that we have to be skinny, first of all, it's an unrealistic goal for many people, and I think we have to be realistic about what is achievable. As we get older, fat becomes harder to manage. We lose some of our fat-burning hormones. And people trying to get back to their 20s, a six-pack abs or something else, it's not futile, but it's very hard. And when you don't get that achievement, I think it makes people want to give up altogether. So having realistic goals about, you know, what is the level of fat we need, what is a healthy amount, and respecting our fat, not hating it, not wanting to get rid of it, kind of taking away that judgment about what fat is, will help. And I'm hoping my book helps at least turn some opinions about fat into something that's more balanced, you know, a more comprehensive perspective of it. So maybe we change the conversation not just to, you know, how good I can look in you know, a dress or skinny jeans. It's more about, do I have healthy fat? And even if I have a little too much, is it distributed in a way that's healthy for me? Is it away from my visceral area? And can I live long-term with this profile?
Sylvia Tara is with us. Her book is The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Sylvia Tara. We're talking about her book, The Secret Life of Fat. Let's come back to you and your own struggles with weight and what you learned about yourself. You say that you believe genetics was really a major contributor here. Your family heritage is Eastern Indian. Talk about the effect on your genetics and give us sort of a broader sense of the role that genes play in all of this.
Yeah, so genes do have a role in fatness, and there are certain, you know, collections of genes, certain specific genes that are now linked to fatness in people. And having them doesn't mean you have to be really fat or you have to be obese. It does mean you will have to work harder at keeping your weight down.
Yeah.
You know, from my own story, I'm pretty sure genetics played a part in it. You know, number one, my mother was almost exactly like me. She really couldn't eat very much at all. She would eat a breakfast. She would eat maybe a snack around noon, and that would be it. And she wasn't skinny for this. You know, she still had a good amount of fat on her, not obese, but heavy. And then, you know, I'm Eastern Indian, and so there's certainly famine in Eastern India.
Right.
I can't help but think that my genotype might be similar to the Pima Indians also. And so going through this research, writing this book, was really to help me understand why some people gain weight so much faster and easier than others. And genetics plays a part, and I think it certainly is a part for me. The other part for me is that, you know, my two X chromosomes don't help women gain weight much
right.
easier than men. The way we partition our nutrients. You know, if say we eat 100 calories or so, women will partition about 30 of those calories into fat, for example, versus a man who might partition 15. And so our biology is different. In fact, girl babies are born fatter than boy babies. So even before birth, possibly, girls are just getting more fat. And we interact with our fat differently. We actually burn it more during exercise, but then we're very good fat stores right after that period. And so we might be using fat more for an hour a day. We're exercising the other 23 hours a day. We're storing fat really well. And it keeps us metabolically healthy, but it does keep us fatter. And so mm-hmm. you know, being a woman played in also. And then age. You know, I'm middle age. My fat-burning hormones like testosterone and growth hormone and estrogen, they're declining.
Right.
And so that meal that I could eat, even the one that I was eating with Lindsay way back when in college, I probably can't even eat that right now. That's even going to make me heavier. So you have to really individualize your diet. You have to look at yourself comprehensively, your biological profile. And so one diet doesn't fit all.
Right.
And so if you're wondering why you're on this diet and everyone else losing weight, but you can't lose weight, don't quickly come to the conclusion, I'm meant to be fat. Just start understanding your fat and your biology. There's things about you that maybe you have to ratchet it up a little bit. You have to try harder. And it's not impossible. And, you know, I work very hard at it. And it's because I wanted to be healthy. You know, I didn't want to be overweight. I think I had 30 pounds extra that I really just couldn't move after a while. You know, I wanted it off, and I had to really work hard, probably harder than most people do, to get those 30 pounds off.
It does raise the question, and I'm sure you've seen this as at least a reaction. I read one reaction to the book that, why is it you brought in the question of willpower? Because that is something that you deal with. You say, look, and you talk about how you fast intermittently, you exercise, you keep a diet log, you count calories. And what you say is, the answer to all of this is you just have to fight. You have to sort of develop this kind of willpower. And I wonder about this approach. As I said, there was one review of the book that kind of hoped you had left that part out. Why did you leave it in, this idea of let's develop, you know, a diet or a proper willpower?
Yeah, so I think the review you're talking about, it wasn't very comprehensive. That's not the only thing I talk about at all.
It's true.
I mean, the book goes on, you know, for a lot about being smarter about how we eat and how we exercise. So not just dieting and exercising, but being very strategic,
yeah.
Especially for stubborn fat. And it's because we're not all the same. There's a lot of things you can do if you are really overweight. There's medical interventions. You can get a gastric bypass. You could do hormone replacement therapy. You could get liposuction if you wanted to, even though your fat might grow back. And there's things out in the future that will come. So brown fat injections might come. Leptin replacement therapy might come. But for right now, what we have is either medical intervention or you have diet and exercise. You know, I chose to go the route of let's try to do this with diet and exercise as much as I possibly can mm-hmm. before I go through any other intervention like hormone replacement therapy, which has its own risk-benefit profile. And so my book really focuses on how can we be smarter about how we diet. If you have stubborn fat, if any of this resonates with you that you don't lose weight easily, it takes you longer to lose it than some, then get smart. Start using hormones, right? Start looking at how we can promote hormones naturally. And when we talk about insulin, a lot of books written on insulin, so refining carbs will help you do that. But also extending the overnight fast. Our growth hormone peaks at night. So if we can extend that overnight fast, we can actually promote the release of growth hormone, extend that release, and that's smart. We can use exercises to promote testosterone and growth hormone too. We can eat for our microbiome. And that's very important to get the bacteria in our gut, not have them extract everything out of our food, not all the calories. And so there's a lot in the book that, you know, the review you're talking about doesn't cover at all.
Yeah.
Now, to be good at any diet at all, however smart and strategic it is, you know, it does require willpower. And so I have a chapter on willpower in the book and how to stay on a diet. There's research done on successful dieters, and what they find is that, you know, number one, they have a very strong motivation. Something's happened in their life. And these are people who've lost, you know, 30 pounds and kept it off for 3 years. They've done pretty well at their long-term dieting. And, you know, what's happened is they've either gotten a medical diagnosis that's making them take their weight loss seriously, or they've gotten a picture of themselves, say, where they look heavier than ever and they want to lose this now.
Right.
And they're so motivated that they can now make decisions where they're choosing the right foods. The other thing about them is that they don't come off their diet almost ever. Even on holidays, they'll stay on. So there's a strong part of dieting that is willpower. You know, another experiment I'll just bring up briefly is that when they do fMRI images analysis of successful dieters' brain, they have them hold a lollipop in their mouth. And their brains get very excited at this, more excited than for obese or normal weight individuals who haven't dieted. But the other part that lights up brightly is the self-control center, so parts of the brain implicated in being able to restrain. So these successful dieters aren't just excited by food. The restraint centers can overtake that emotional response that the organ has. And so the self-control becomes really important. Even if I were to tell you to eat cake 3 times a day, that was your diet, you'd need self-control to stay on that. You'd want pudding one day or
right.
something else, right? And so that's, you know, self-control is an element. Obesity is not all down to self-control, or controlling obesity, rather. I mean, it's down to what you do, your activities, your food. But then to be on any plan whatsoever, I think we have to exercise, you know, build up a self-control muscle, if you will, and it's possible to do. You can take small acts and reinforce them that lead to them bigger accomplishments later. And so I don't want to, you know, shortchange that too. I think just to be on any kind of plan, even just to avoid diabetes or any kind of medical, you know, plan that you have, willpower and control becomes a part of maintaining that for the long term. So don't pick a diet for 6 months. Pick a diet that you can do for years and years.
Yeah.
And then, you know, exercise it. Exercise, you know, the control, the self-control muscles, make them strong so you can stay on it no matter what your environment is.
One of the big questions related to weight control over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years has been the role of, or the debate anyway, between carbohydrates versus fat. Where do you come down on that question in terms of, you know, weight gain and fat?
Yeah, so there's a number of diets out there, and there's not a one diet fits all. It really depends on a lot of things. One is it depends on your biology. You know, I know people who can eat carbohydrates all day long and not gain weight, and I bet you a carbohydrate diet is fine for them.
Yeah.
You know, I know people who can't, and again, it depends on our genetics. It depends on our hormones. It depends on our individual biology. But not just that, a diet has to work for you psychologically as well. Mm-hmm. It has to be a diet that you can stay on. If it's omitting a food that's incredibly important to you, you might not want to pick that diet. It has to work for you socially as well. There's diets that involve intense meal prep and 2 hours of exercise a day. If you're really busy, that's not going to work for you. You know, like I said, you have to pick it not just for 6 months. This is going to be your life. Mm-hmm. You know, dieting is a lifelong endeavor. And so
if you have the right genetic variation, paleo, for example, could potentially work for you, but won't work for everyone, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and not just because of your genetics, but because your lifestyle, you know, your willingness to be on a diet like that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, carbohydrate diets, they can work fine. I think when you try to mix fat and carbohydrate together, that's when they don't work. So if you're either all fat, I think it works well. You can go on one of these ketogenic diets, and they work fairly well. Very restrictive. So can you be on that diet long term if you're really busy and don't have time for food prep and shopping for specific, you know, foods for a very restricted diet? You know, but then if you can just do the carbohydrate too, if you're not mixing fat in, and if you have a body disposition where that doesn't really make you gain weight. I know I'm very sensitive to carbohydrates. It's one of the things that I cut out that really helped me keep the weight off. Mm.
Let me ask you this finally. You ask this question at the end of the book. If we manage to get a hold on obesity, and that's a big question, of course, but would that be the end of our fat obsession? That's the question you ask. What do you think? Would it?
Oh, that's a great question. That's very futuristic sounding. So, you know, if we ever get a hold on our obesity, you know, there would still be gradations of fat, and I can't help but think that society would still judge us based on how much or how little fat we have. You know, fat, it's weird. It's like a fashion, and when it's hard to come by like it was after the Civil War, fat is status, right? And it's status in some countries still, right? Fat is a symbol of wealth, and people want fat. And yet when we're able to get fat, the opposite happens. Being thin is this status symbol of being able to control yourself, you know, of being in very good shape. And so fat is, it's more than just fat, if you will. Even socially, it's more than fat. It's kind of this judgment. There's all these different, you know, concepts, these ideas imputed onto fat. So if we got a hold of obesity, I think overall, you know, the health of America would be better. You know, we'd have a handle on something that's been very hard to attract here. But I think there would still be judgment even on the smaller gradations of weight just because of how we think about fat. And unless we turn around how we think about fat and start to appreciate it for what it truly is, which I try to do with my book a little bit, I think it'll continue to be a judgment on people.
Sylvia Tara. Her book is The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You. She joined us from the studios of public radio station KUCI at the University of California, Irvine. Sylvia Tara, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Michael Havey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.